We are joined live in the studios once again by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local activists and writers here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So, another stellar busy week.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In our fair city.
Yeah. So let's talk about reactionary leaders. We can start with Mayor Durkan.
Start with the mayor.
We can start with the mayor. This week, the city, under Mayor Durkan's oversight.
Alleged leadership.
Yes, presented a plan to the court for addressing problems with the new Seattle Police Officers Guild contract, particularly around the disciplinary process for officers accused of using excessive force. Excuse me. While Durkan's plan answers half of Judge Robart's order to present a plan of action and timeline, it doesn't answer the main part of his order, which is to specify how the city will alter the disciplinary process to bring it in compliance with a standard of constitutional policing. Now, the plan has changed somewhat from its first draft, but it's still the same proposal, hiring an outside consulting firm to evaluate how Seattle's current disciplinary process compares to 20 other cities around the country to try to identify what a good disciplinary process would look like. Now, the community, and then use that in negotiations with the Seattle Police Officers Guild, not on this current contract, but on the next contract.
Hasn't the court already laid out what that would look like?
Yeah.
We don't need to study.
That work has already been done, according to the Community Police Commission, who worked with folks drafting the legislation that the city council passed back in 2017, which set forth what they thought would be a good disciplinary process. So that work has already been done.
So Mayor Durkan doesn't like that answer. So she's starting with the answer and working backwards, trying to get a study group that will give her what she wants.
Yeah, essentially. Or she's trying to get a study that will show that the current system in the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract, which she is trying to get approved, that disciplinary process is actually pretty good compared to other cities. That's what she's trying to do.
And didn't we have a judge that reversed a firing that was...
Back in May, Judge Robart talked about the case of police officer Adley Shepard, who was fired for punching a handcuffed woman in the back of his patrol car. Shepard was reinstated. He got his job back with back pay after he appealed his case to an arbitrator who had a limited experience with police conduct issues. Robart pointed to Shepard's case as an example of why the current disciplinary process is still unconstitutional. It allows police officers to shop around the appeals for their disciplinary cases to the most favorable arbitrator that they can find, arbitrators that have less experience in police accountability issues than oversight folks within the Seattle Police Department or even the police chief herself. Yesterday, King County Superior Court Judge John McHale agreed with Judge Robart's assessment of Shepard's case. McHale overturned the arbitrator's ruling, saying that Shepard's firing should stand and that letting the arbitrator's ruling stand would set a bad precedent, one that says it's okay to let officers take out their frustration or anger by abusing people who are handcuffed or otherwise restrained in their custody.
And that disciplinary process is what Mayor Durkan wants to preserve.
Yeah.
And SPOG wants to preserve as well.
Yeah, Durkan and city lawyers have argued that Shepard's case is an exception, not the rule. But Robart didn't buy that, and he didn't see anything in the new contract that would prevent this from happening again, because it maintains essentially the same disciplinary process in place. Now, the Community Police Commission is expected to file their own opinion with the court. Judge Robart will read all of the material that he receives, both from the Community Police Commission, the report from the city, and also the concurring opinion from the Department of Justice. And when he's ready, he may either issue a ruling outright or he may schedule a hearing first to ask questions of the various parties about the mayor's plan.
And unlike the instructions from the judge, Mayor Durkan, in submitting that proposal, did not consult any of the stakeholders, the CPC or the Department of Justice, any of those folks.
Well, she said that her consulting firm did seek the opinion of the CPC and meet with other stakeholders, but those folks said, I believe those folks are un, are saying that her consulting firm didn't really incorporate their concerns within this plan.
Yes.
Because the Community Police Commission has come out in complete opposition to it.
Yeah, they unanimously submitted that that plan was not sufficient at all.
Yeah.
It sounds similar to what happens when during city council hearings, when a packed room will say consistently say the same message to city council, and they turn around and ignore that input.
Yeah, pretty much. And you know, as the Community Police Commission said, you know, all of this work that Mayor Durkin wants to do in order to try to evaluate options for a new disciplinary process, that's all been done. You know, and Judge Robart has already ruled that the disciplinary process that's currently in this new contract that the mayor just negotiated with the Seattle Police Officers Guild, that is not sufficient, it's not constitutional. Now, the folks representing the city, Durkin's representatives, all say that they can't reopen negotiations on the contract because that would be a violation of labor law. On the other hand, Judge Robart has said, and he said multiple times, that labor unions cannot bargain away the constitutional rights of the citizens of Seattle as part of a labor contract. He has said that, and he said it and he's affirmed it. And that means that if a contract attempts to do that, that should be grounds for being able to reopen the negotiations. In addition, there are reopeners listed within the new contract. Things that can be used as a reason to reopen the contract, and among those are some things that are part of the disciplinary process. For example, one of the things we haven't talked much about is the fact that the oversight bodies within the Seattle Police Department don't have subpoena power to get evidence in order to hear disciplinary cases.
Yeah, neither does the OPA.
Yeah, the OPA is part of that. So that is one of the things that can be used. That's one of the reopeners within the contract. And if Mayor Durkin would exercise those reopeners, then we could be making progress here. But she's refused to do that.
And you know, the reality on the ground with this is that Mayor Durkin is delaying any changes to the current system that she wants to. Incorporate any changes in the contract negotiated in 2021, I believe.
Yeah, well, they'll need to start negotiating the contract next year because this current contract, which has not been approved yet, expires in December of 2020.
And, you know, the reality is that they may not come to agreement in time for that because they certainly didn't come to agreement in 2014. That's why we're still working off the very old contract, because SPOG wants to hang on to those disciplinary processes as long as they can, and apparently Mayor Durkin does too. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get more rulings like the judges yesterday, Judge Robart, because they're not doing constitutional policing, and you know Mayor Durkin seems to like it that way and wants to delay as long as possible any court-ordered changes.
Yeah.
When is she up for election again?
2021.
Yeah.
So, anybody who wants to run against her should start preparing now.
Yeah.
Just saying.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Let's move on then to
City Council and the Green New Deal.
Yeah. This week, the City Council passed a resolution for a Green New Deal in Seattle. And because it's a resolution and not an ordinance, it's non-binding. But it sets some interesting goals for the city, for the city council to use in evaluating ordinances and deciding what to fund in the city budget. City budget negotiations are going to start next month for next year's budget. Now, the overall goal in the Green New Deal is to make Seattle free of climate pollutants, in other words, greenhouse gases, by the year 2030. That's just a little over 10 years from now. So that's a very ambitious deadline and more ambitious than many folks are talking about on the national stage. It would prioritize investment in low-income communities and communities of color, and it would create stable, local, well-paying union jobs. Those are the goals, at any rate. And to reach the goals, there are many things in the Green New Deal for Seattle. And so I recommend folks go online and read more about it. But two of the first things that it says in there is to create a fund with a dedicated revenue source, and that directly will influence budget negotiations, I think, and to form an associated accountability body or board to oversee how those funds are spent and how the city moves towards a green transition.
So I'm a little skeptical of this resolution for a couple of reasons. Number one, City Council does have a history of passing resolutions and then not following up on them. And last year, the city did very little to change Mayor Durkin's proposed budget. So I would recommend that not only people go and read the details of this, because it is a very detailed proposal.
Yeah, and it's got some very good things in it.
But then the pressure needs to be put on City Council to follow through in the budget negotiations and incorporate some of these goals.
Yeah.
Because, you know, time's a waste.
Now, I want to point out that the city has already begun to do some of the things in that are listed in the Green New Deal. So in a way, it's kind of putting in one place a whole lot of other efforts that have been ongoing, with especially with the current city council, from, you know, strengthening green building standards, trying to legislate the building of infrastructure for electric vehicles, for example, upzoning to create more density, especially near transit hubs, that sort of thing. So it's worth looking at, and looking at the parts of the Green New Deal that the city has been pushing forward and the parts that they have been falling down on the job. So Mike O'Brien, who introduced the resolution in his committee, is working on a companion bill right now to set up the accountability board, which has been mentioned in this new resolution. And during the budget hearings, which, like I said, are going to start next month, I think we're going to see him propose a bill or amendment for a dedicated fund and funding source for this. And like I said, we may see a lot of other changes to the budget to bring it in line with the goals set forth in the Green New Deal. Like Jav said, last year, the city council didn't like Mayor Durkin's priorities in the budget, but they didn't make a whole lot of changes. It'll be interesting to see if they're willing to roll up their sleeves, sit down, and do the long, hard work of moving money around, which they didn't do last time.
Yeah, and there's a particular urgency to that since, of course, we may have a very different city council after January.
Yes.
You know, we've got very well-funded corporate candidates in almost all the races. So, you know, the composition of the council may be much more pro-business after January.
Yeah,
so
and I think the
changes that can be made to the budget have to be made, you know, by the end of the year for this budget cycle.
Yeah, typically the mayor releases her budget plan in September and the city council starts working on it in September, and they work on it through October and November, and they try to pass a final version of the budget right before Thanksgiving. That's typically the timeline. So it'll be interesting to see how hard they want to work on it and how it's going to go. Now, I know Mike O'Brien has been working like a whirlwind to try to get transportation bills passed in his Sustainability and Transportation Committee, particularly things like, he's got a couple of bills that would hold the mayor and the Seattle Department of Transportation accountable for building out the bike lane network, including a bill that would require the city to include protected bike lanes in any repaving project that involves a street that's been listed in the bicycle master plan. And this is in response to the mayor deciding not to include bike lanes in the 35th Avenue Northeast repaving project, and Seattle Department of Transportation dropping many of the bike lane projects out of the Move Seattle levy, especially bike lanes for South and South Seattle, Southeast Seattle, which are very poorly served for transportation alternatives. He's also working on a resolution to request that the mayor commit to building out the bicycle master plan and that she find funding for it in this year's budget. So I think that means that he's going to be looking at that really closely, and he's going to be moving money around if she doesn't.
And the Move Seattle levy being a good example of something that was passed and then dramatically changed later.
It was passed with a lot of promises of we'll collect X amount of money and we'll build all of these projects, when in fact yes, the city did collect a pretty good amount of money, but it wasn't enough to build all of the projects that the former SDOT leader had identified.
And, you know, every time we see one of these levies on the ballot, that comes with a list of proposed projects,
yeah.
you know, there's a reason why we emphasize that these are proposed projects and that's not necessarily what the city's going to do, because they have the option of moving money around afterwards.
Yeah, they do. And Scott Kubley, who was in charge of SDOT at the time, I think came under a lot of criticism after the Move Seattle levy passed, and it turned out that those projects were more expensive than SDOT had estimated.
Didn't he go on to being in charge of the company that's leaving bikes all over the sidewalks now?
Yeah.
I believe so.
I believe so, yeah.
One of those companies. I realize there's several.
Lime Bike, I think.
Could be.
Awesome.
anything else on
nope.
that? Okay.
Nope.
Let's move on to update this week on the Mercer Mega Block.
Yeah, I was looking at the Mercer Mega Block sale again. Erica Barnett managed to get copies of the seven different proposals that different companies made to the city for the purchase of the Mercer Mega Block. And I was looking at it because I had seen someone commenting on a Facebook post saying that they thought the $38 million credit for 175 units of affordable housing was about right, that $217,000 was about right for building each unit in the Seattle market. So I took a look at the other proposals to see what the other developers had proposed, assuming that they would try to get as big a credit as they could for providing affordable housing. And what I was surprised to see was that at least three other developers were offering more affordable housing units, and that those developers that offered the same number as Alexandria Real Estate, which is the city's choice for the sale, that at least a few of those other developers valued their low-income housing units at a much lower value than Alexandria did. Alexandria managed to negotiate with the city a $38 million credit off the price of the land for those 175 units, meaning that they valued them at about $217,000. Now, when I looked at, for example, Kilroy Realty, they had one of their options was a proposal for 175 units of affordable housing, which they valued at a discount of $24 million, a good one-third less than what Alexandria's proposal was. In addition, Alexandria, in their proposal, in their documents that they released to Barnett and to the public, they blacked out all of the financing information for the low-income housing, and they blacked out completely the mix of housing units that they would provide. So we don't know if any family housing is being built there. We do know that Kilroy Realty had proposed that their units be a mix of units for people who make 30%, 50%, and 60% of AMI. So some very low income housing among the mix they would have offered. And they specified 35 two-bedroom units and 8 three-bedroom units, so there would be at least some of those units would be family housing.
So the bottom line here is that the city was much more concerned about commercial development than they were about building more affordable housing.
Yeah, that's the reason they chose Alexandria. Now, Alexandria is, they're not just real estate developers. They're also venture capitalists, so they have a division that funds life science startups. And in their proposal, they essentially said, so when you read between the lines, what you see in their proposal is that they want the land to build on. They're not necessarily going to rent it out to whoever is the first comer. They work with and fund life science startups, so they have a group of companies they can already put in there. Essentially, they need the office space. So it's a little bit like saying, hey, Amazon, do you need more headquarters? They're essentially saying, you know, the city's essentially saying, well, what commercial development is going to help the business community that exists already in South Lake Union and bring even more growth and even more jobs in a mix of life science, you know, because there are all these life sciences labs and commercial properties there already. What's going to fit there? What's going to add to the booming growth in South Lake Union? And the affordable housing was just sort of a nice little sideline, you know, as long as they provide the minimum of 175 units as the city requested, you know, we'll go with this proposal because it's the best for the business community in South Lake Union. that's what it really looks like. But we don't know for sure because Alexandria Real Estate has withheld all of the data that would allow us to evaluate their offering of low-income units, unlike the six other proposals where you can see all that information.
And again, as Erica Barnett has previously pointed out in her writings, to get the unredacted version of that would take a lawsuit.
Yeah.
Even though it's a public document.
The city warned her. The city told her when they released the documents to her that it was the developer, Alexandria Real Estate, who redacted all that information. And if she wanted to get it, she would have to directly sue Alexandria Real Estate. And in which case, she would have to actually push against Alexandria Real Estate. And Alexandria Real Estate could slap suit her, could turn around and sue her back, and that the city would not then help her fight that case.
It's too bad we just don't have a city council member that could get that unredacted document.
It would
for
be
us.
Nice if we had a city council member who has a copy of that unredacted document, because I'm pretty sure that the city council would be legally required to have the full documents, right? Or a city employee who could release that to her and say, okay, well, it's unfortunate.
Or release that to any media.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that the developer, redacted all this information because it should be public.
Yeah.
And again, as we were talking about earlier, this is all going to go to City Council. Potentially, they can make tweaks to it, even though
I don't think, because it looks to me like the city has already entered a formal agreement, and the developer Alexandria Real Estate made an earnest money payment back in February.
So this is another example where the city negotiates something behind closed doors, and by the time it gets to a public hearing, it's a done deal.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think there are going to be many changes at all that the city council will be able to make to it at this point.
Well, it seems like an odd system to not have some type of either public hearing or some mechanisms for tweaking these contracts that we are bound to.
Or even renegotiating them.
Yeah.
What irks me, too, is that the city only asked for 175 units of affordable housing, and at least a couple of the different proposals proposed many more housing units. Vulcan, for example, put in a bid that would have allowed the city to get 535 units of low-income housing. So that's more than three times the 175-unit minimum. And those houses would have been built, those units would have been built fairly quickly under this proposal. It wouldn't have been, if you opt for the cash, which they did with Alexandria Real Estate, you're going to be able to build those units as quickly. No, that cash will go into the fund, into a city-owned fund. The city will take proposals from real estate developers or nonprofits. They'll evaluate those proposals. They will disperse money. It will take years to get those units built. When you have an agreement like this, the units get built much faster. And Vulcan was offering to build three times the number of units, but they weren't putting up as much cash up front.
So the city is not prioritizing affordable housing.
No, not in this deal.
In a neighborhood where, the social
where
services
desperately needed. Yeah.
Yeah, the social services that people who are very low income often need are relatively nearby.
Yeah,
they'd rather disperse the low income housing to
far flung neighborhoods.
To far flung neighborhoods that don't have those services nearby.
Yeah, and some of the other proposals too offered great benefits like a childcare facility, like an outdoor children's playground, things that would or a school. One proposal offered to build a school for the Seattle School District. So there are things there that downtown families have really, really wanted and needed and pretty desperately needed for a long time. But the city opted instead for the proposal that benefited the South Lake Union business community.
And again, this is something that the city has utterly failed the plan, because they've been pushing to add residential units to the downtown core for several years now, but they have done nothing to invest in schools or parks or the kind of infrastructure that families moving into the downtown or South Lake Union area really need. It's simply not happening.
And they're here they have an opportunity to require the developer to do that, and they passed it by.
Yep.
So it seems like there needs to be some
more oversight of how the city strikes these deals. Yeah.
Well, and perhaps,
which again goes to city council.
Perhaps some more work on looking into how this all came about and some of the mechanics of it, so that we can fix things properly in the future.
Yeah.
Again, this is something the city does a lot, is negotiate something behind closed doors, and it's a done deal by the time it gets to any kind of public hearing or public review. And that's something that needs to change, but it's an approach that Mayor Durkan seems really, really wed to.
Yeah,
she's been worse on that than a lot of recent mayors.
Yeah, and these things that we're talking about that downtown residents have wanted, that low-income housing advocates have wanted, these are not new. We've been talking about, you know, they've been talking about it at the city council level for years now. You know, let's require developers to provide infrastructure. Let's require, you know, let's build some family housing. Let's try to get developers to do a maximum of housing rather than a minimum.
And this goes to the city's failure to provide to require any kind of impact fees, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, okay, I suspect we'll be coming back to this.
Yeah. Probably, yes.
Oh, yeah.
The need is still there.
All right. Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, while we are speaking live here at the moment on Saturday afternoon, many people are in the streets down in Portland.
Yeah, and there's a lot of white nationalism things going on this week. The Seattle Times has an article out on the Trump supporters coming out of the woodwork in Seattle, which is not new because most of the people involved in the city council campaigns for the sort of NIMBY, Safe Seattle, and folks like that. Most of those folks are Trump supporters. I've overheard them in public hearings talking about how much they love Trump. Mm-hmm. So that's not particularly new, but some of the deep-pocketed people that are dominant in Seattle politics are named in that article. That's interesting. We also had a hung jury this week for the trial of the people who shot Josh Dukes, an anti-FA protester, or counter-protester, rather, in the Milo appearance on the day of Trump's inauguration in 2016.
At the UW campus.
At the UW campus, yeah. And that resulted in a hung jury, and the foreman came out and said, well, you know, he was very frustrated because it was a hung jury because there were people on the jury who, for ideological reasons, were supporting the shooting, which is a real problem in terms of jury selection. But
you're entitled to a jury of your peers, and the folks who turn out for Milo Yiannopoulos's talks tend to be, you know, white supremacists. So
yes, so they got a jury of
this
their peers.
This was true. They did get a jury of their peers,
and it'll be interesting to see whether the King County prosecutor decides to try and retry that case.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, down in Portland, at least 1,000 far-right protesters are expected this afternoon, as well as a similar number of counter-protesters, at least. So Portland is bracing itself for some violence. The police there are already tried to round up some of the far-right ringleaders. Joey Gibson, for example, was arrested, and some of the other people who were organizing this far-right rally were rounded up ahead of time. But that doesn't necessarily stop the rally from happening. So this is the sort of thing where a lot of the people who are down in Portland are from this area, or at least from Washington State, and we can expect things like that in Seattle as well. There's a whole list of reasons why this has come to pass in Portland, which I won't get into the local politics down there. But it is a sign of the times and a sign of how our resident idiot in chief has energized these far right groups that they come out and have these tiki torch bearing rallies in a relatively liberal city like Portland or Seattle. So brace yourself because it's coming here.
Arun Gupta has reported he's been doing video feeds and photos and comments as this transpires, and pointed out that Portland Police Department escorted approximately 500 of the Proud Boys and their allies across the Hawthorne Bridge, and then promptly
that's a bridge into downtown. Mm-hmm.
Then promptly cut off the Antifa and media from being able to follow. So just in terms of numbers, that gives you a sense of how many potential people, at least on one side, are there. And also illustrating the cooperative nature of the Portland Police Department with far-right groups that do protests in
Portland.
It's
worth noting, too, that a lot of these far-right white supremacist groups are staffed by, you know, ex-police. They're often funded by people who were former military people, sometimes people who are active military, and they are funded by a lot of those same folks. So, yeah, there's a lot of friendliness between the police agencies and these groups.
Yeah, and there's been a couple of steps between these, but the whole genesis of all this was a Black Lives Matter type protest of a Portland police shooting of an unarmed Black teenager back in June. Mm-hmm. And then far right people rallying in objection to this trying to hold the police accountable. Yeah. So that's the genesis of all this in Portland.
And one other item which will have influence on today's potential outcomes was Donald Trump tweeting last night. And as much as I hate to mention his tweets, tweeting major consideration is being given to naming Antifa an organization of terror in quotes around it. And he specifically mentions Portland. Portland is being watched very carefully. Hopefully the mayor will be able to properly do his job.
Yeah, so this is the danger of talking about, you know, using domestic terrorism laws to go after people who do mass shootings or people in the far right, in these far right groups, is because depending on who's in the White House and or who's at the helm of the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security, those laws are usually turned away from far right groups and are used against people on the left.
Yeah, and you instead. Can and this is a far right talking point playing up Antifa. You know, it's not an organization. It's an ideology, basically. And, you know, trying to name an ideology as an agent of terror is rife for all kinds of potential abuse.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on to national, if we may.
Sure. Okay.
So
yeah.
Starting out with the White House and Treasury Department.
Yeah, we had a number of economic indicators this week that suggested that both globally and domestically we're moving toward a recession. Of course, the first part of that this week was China deciding to devalue the yuan, and that led to the stock market dropping 800 points or so on Monday. What we found from the Washington Post later in the week is that the White House and Treasury Department are planning no steps in case there's a recession in the United States, because they don't want to upset the idiot in chief, who is he is pegging his reelection on the concept that the economy is wonderful, and so they don't want to upset him by suggesting that the economy might not be so wonderful in 2020. If it does move in that direction, there will be no additional steps taken. And
there's no backstop
in place. There's no backstop in place. There's no plan B. And this is sort of typical of the Trump administration, that they don't plan for these kind of contingencies because they don't want to offend the commander-in-chief.
Who is
in complete denial about all this. Mm-hmm. And is operating with a separate set of facts and a separate reality of his own narcissistic making. So that's a little disturbing for anybody who is hoping that we don't have a major economic downturn in the next 12 months.
All right, moving on. Clean water.
There were several things this week that emphasized that with the Trump administration, don't pay attention to the tweets, don't pay attention to the diversionary tactics, pay attention to what they do.
Yeah. This week, 29 states and cities filed lawsuit against the rollback of the Clean Power Plan. They filed suit to block the Trump administration from essentially gutting the Clean Power Plan, which had been proposed by the Obama administration. Now, the Clean Power Plan would have required states to draw plans to limit carbon dioxide emissions, especially from coal-burning power plants, by the year 2022. States had the flexibility to take whatever path they wanted as long as they cut their emissions, and that could mean using carbon capture technology, closing old plants or closing coal-burning plants, investing in natural gas, or moving towards renewable energy like solar wind or geothermal. Now, some critics of the Clean Power Plan on the left said that natural gas is not clean power. That was one of the main, and the other one being that the federal government should set standards, not the states setting their own standards. The federal government in the Clean Power Plan would have said, yes, we do set these standards. However, we're going to let the states figure out how to get there. Now, Donald Trump threw out the Clean Power Plan, and he proposed a new rule known as the Affordable Clean Energy Rule. It sets no limits on greenhouse gas emissions, period. It allows states to decide if they want to cut emissions or not. And if they do, they can pick from a list of energy-efficient technologies, but not necessarily technologies that would cut greenhouse gas emissions. So this week, 29 states led by Democratic governors sued the Trump administration, saying that this that the EPA is required to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. Supreme Court, in fact, has ruled on that already, and that the Trump administration is not only ignoring its responsibility to do so, it's doing the opposite with the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, because it would allow states to build new coal-powered plants if they, as long as they're using energy-efficient means.
Yeah, meanwhile, we had saw significant rollbacks on the environmental front in a couple other areas. The Clean Water Act, which has been in place since the Nixon administration, empowers states to decide how they want to keep clean water. And the Trump administration decided, no, we don't want the states to do that. We want to control that. So we're taking that power away from the states. That, of course, states' rights used to be a conservative talking point, but that's all changed.
Well, yeah, I mean, they got the Clean Power Plan to for the principle of states' rights, and here they are violating the principle of states' rights. So the Republicans are never consistent.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the Endangered Species Act took a significant hit this week, mm-hmm. with the Trump administration enacting new rules that, for the first time, decide we'll look at whether a species is endangered. But under the Endangered Species Act, again, since the Nixon administration, that those listings depend on the science and no other considerations. Now, we have to decide whether there's economic benefit to letting species go extinct, and we'll take that into consideration. For instance, if we want to develop land for oil extraction or for mining, and that has a wetlands that's going to send a species into extinction, too bad. Because it's more important to have the short-term economic development.
Yeah, and in fact, that goes against the wording of the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah, so you can expect some
so
lawsuits around that.
You can expect a lawsuit that will probably halt that. We hope, anyway. I also want to say that for folks who are wondering, Washington State is part of that lawsuit against the Trump administration.
The 29 state lawsuit.
Yeah, the 29 cities and states, 23 states. Okay. And in fact, six cities are part of that lawsuit, but not Seattle, not yet. We'll see.
Yes, but Attorney General Bob Ferguson is on the case.
Is on the case.
As he usually is when it comes to suing Trump.
Yeah, and in fact, he has a very good record against the Trump administration so far.
Well,
yeah.
There's a lot of material to work with.
There certainly is.
He keeps winning those lawsuits.
Yeah.
So bets on whether he will be jumping in with the Endangered Species Act challenge?
I think that's very highly likely.
Yeah.
All right. And last week we didn't have time to touch on that the USDA apparently is losing a significant number of scientists.
Yeah, we got a new tactic from the Trump administration back in June where they decided they really want to get rid of the scientists in the USDA who were doing studies on the impact of climate change on agriculture and on farmers. Now, that can be very useful studies for farmers to try and figure out how to mitigate the effects of climate change. But when you have an administration that doesn't believe climate change is happening, that can be inconvenient science. So what they decided to do was abruptly move those arms of the USDA from Washington, D.C. to Kansas City. And they gave the people in those departments, including all the scientists, 30 days to decide whether they wanted to move their families halfway across the country.
Sell their homes, yank their kids out of school.
Yeah, and of course, many of the scientists objected to that. And so some two-thirds of the scientists in the USDA have left the USDA rather than moved to Kansas City. And we had Nick Mulvaney, the chief of staff to President Trump, the acting chief of staff, crowing in a conservative audience in South Carolina last week that, hey, this is a great way to get rid of the federal employees that that for reasons of labor contracts are very hard to fire. We can just force them to move and they won't move, so they'll quit. This is awesome. You can expect this tactic for various other departments coming up in the near future.
Yeah, and you know, when you depopulate departments like that, they stop being able to actually do their jobs. So,
And we've seen that with the State Department already.
Yeah, some of Trump's major constituents, in this case, farmers and agricultural communities, may begin to see that the programs that they rely on are going to not be working well for them because there just aren't enough people to help administer them.
And this is something that's core to President Trump's reelection campaign. He is raising an enormous amount of money from corporate America, and the reason is they're totally happy with the dismantling of the regulatory infrastructure of the government. Mm-hmm. This is happening apace, and it's not getting as much attention as it should because the media keeps fixating on Trump's tweets and his outrageous behavior.
Yeah, it
again,
is the main.
Watch what they do, not what they say.
Yes, it is the main feature of the Trump administration is this massive move to deregulate.
Yeah, and it's something that even if Trump does not get a second term, it will take literally decades to rebuild some of the infrastructure that he's shredded in only 3 years.
All right. Well, sticking with the concept of future terms, Maria, you are continuing your evaluation of some of the presidential candidates.
Yeah. The top five on this week on gun safety. And it's interesting because not every candidate has a gun safety policy on his or her website, at least not prior to this week. But most of them have released policies in the media in some form over the course of this week. Joe Biden was one of those. His policy I call the ban assault weapons again policy. Biden is one of the candidates who doesn't have a policy listed on his website, but he wrote an editorial for the New York Times this week that outlines what his gun safety issues would be. Now, when Biden was a senator, he supported the 1994 bill to ban assault weapons, which expired in 2004. And he has said that he is committed to trying to get a permanent assault weapons ban passed with a ban on high-capacity magazines. He would also like to stop gun manufacturers from making small changes to assault weapons that would let them get around that law. He would like to put in place a buyback program. And this is very important because a lot of people say if you ban assault weapons, there are still millions of them out there.
As well as the high-capacity magazines.
Yeah, yeah. So he would put in place a buyback program for assault weapons that would remove them from people's homes and the streets. Of course, that would be a very expensive program to get the millions of weapons off the street. He would also support a bill for universal background checks. He voted for the Brady Bill in 1993, which put in place the current background check system. So he does have a history of supporting background check legislation. He also supports smart gun technology like fingerprint readers that key a weapon to the gun's owner. So stolen weapons can't be used on the street and kids can't get their hands on their parents' guns without them knowing. Now, these are good popular policies, but they rely very heavily on a Congress that would be willing to pass that legislation in order to implement them.
Yeah, and that would require probably 60 votes in the Senate.
Yeah. Now, Elizabeth Warren, she's now the number two candidate in the polls. She has what I call the detailed plan. Warren also released her plan just last weekend with the specific goal of decreasing gun deaths in the United States by 80%. And here's some of the things she would do to do that. She starts out by saying she'd take executive action to hold gun dealers accountable, including expanding background checks to nearly all gun sales, expanding the requirement to report mass purchases of certain rifles, and raising the minimum age for buying a gun to 18. Things that she could do as the executive. She would take executive action to hold gun manufacturers accountable, including revoking licenses for gun dealers who break the law, which very seldom happens now, prosecuting gun traffickers, and investigating the NRA's nonprofit status, which she believes they violate on a regular basis.
And I believe the New York Attorney General is already doing that.
Yes. And she would, in addition, push Congress to pass anti-corruption legislation to make it harder for lobbyists to sway Congress, and would push Congress to pass a bill to end the filibuster, which she believes really benefits groups like the NRA. She will also push for comprehensive gun violence legislation, including creation of a federal licensing system, a universal background check law, banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, raising taxes on guns from 10% to 30% on guns and 50% on ammunition, capping the number of firearms that can be purchased to one per month, et cetera, et cetera. She just has a long, long list, and it's very worth checking out and reading the details.
And I want to say parenthetically here, I don't put much stock in polls this far out from an election, but there was a Fox News poll this week that showed that not only Biden, but all of the leading Democratic candidates were leading Trump by 8 to 10 points.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's actually been going on for a while,
yeah,
in polls, but that would match each candidate to Trump.
Yes.
Trump almost always either tied or fell well under the Democratic candidates in popularity.
This is like all the leading Democratic candidates are well ahead of him.
Now.
And Trump's negative rating was 56%, which is the highest it's been anywhere. And again, this is a Fox News poll, which you would expect to normally skew in his favor.
Yeah.
So that means for Democratic voters, that if you're worried about finding somebody who can beat Trump, the ideologically more left candidates can do that as well.
Yeah,
you don't have to sacrifice ideology for somebody able to beat Trump.
Yes, I want to emphasize that is not just Joe Biden who's well ahead of Trump. Elizabeth Warren polls well ahead of Trump as well, and so does Bernie Sanders. Polls well ahead of him. And some of the others, like Buttigieg, polls well ahead of him, too. So you have to get down to the lesser-known candidates in the Democratic field to get any people who are within striking distance for Trump. So I just want to say to people, if you're going for Biden or for someone because you think they're electable, that's the wrong tack to take. Look at their policies and decide on the policies, because I'm telling you, any of these well-known Democratic candidates stand a very, very good chance of beating Trump.
Yeah.
So now, so I just want to say about Elizabeth Warren's plan. Her plan gets very detailed and has much more in it than any of the other candidates that I looked at, but also more than the current Congress is likely to pass in terms of legislation. But quite a bit of it doesn't rely on Congress, and that's better than what I'm seeing from most of the other Democrats in the field. Now, Bernie Sanders, he's third in the polls right now. He has a mixed background on guns, and it's one of the issues that he's quite weak on. He has a very vague kind of policy.
Although, in fairness, he's been representing Vermont, which is a rural state with a lot of guns.
Yeah, he has, and since 2016, when he ran for president and got criticized heavily on supporting on his background supporting guns, he has switched how he supports gun safety legislation now. Now, he has said that he is willing to take on the NRA to expand background checks, including to guns sold at gun shows, to ban assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines, to crack down on straw purchasers who buy guns for criminals who can't pass background checks. And as a senator, Sanders has voted against, he did vote in 1993 against the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act. And he voted for bills in 2003 and 2005 to protect gun companies from lawsuits if their guns are used in crimes. But like I say, since 2016, he's reversed his position on those votes and on those types of bills. He changed his mind about passing a bill to repeal the law that protects gun companies from lawsuits. So he would support that now. And he has been a consistent supporter since the 1980s of banning assault weapons. He voted for the 1994 assault weapons ban when it became law, and he supported efforts to renew it. So he's got a mixed background. It's not totally terrible. Many gun control groups now consider him an ally. But again, he's still vulnerable on this issue. Now, Kamala Harris, she's fourth in popularity. Her policy I call the tough on guns policy. And this is one area where she's actually quite knowledgeable. When she was attorney general for California, she worked a lot on gun safety issues. So she knows quite a bit about it. And she has said that if Congress doesn't send her a gun control bills to sign, she will take executive action to mandate near universal background checks, just like Elizabeth Warren has said. And everyone who sells five or more guns per year would be required to run background checks on all gun sales uh, in in the action she would take. She will revoke.
And that would exempt, you know, private sales from like friend to friend, but it would.
And family member to family member.
Yeah, but it would close the gun
show loophole. Yeah. And she said she will revoke the licenses of and prosecute gun manufacturers who willfully break federal, state, or local laws, similar to what Elizabeth Warren has said. Including selling guns to straw purchasers, supplying dealers who consistently sell guns used in crimes, or by marketing assault weapons to kids in video games. She would use her power under the Gun Control Act to ban the importation of assault weapons. 4 million assault weapons are imported into the U.S. each year. And she would fight to get Congress to pass a number of laws similar to what the other Democrats have said. So Harris is actually very good on this issue, and she knows the details and she knows the legalities of it, having worked on a lot of this stuff as Attorney General for the state of California. Now, that brings me to Pete Buttigieg, who's number five on the list. I call his policy the Expand the Security State First policy. He would spend $1 billion to prevent and combat radicalization and violent extremism. He would expand the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, state police, and local police departments with more money, technology, and staff to track domestic terrorists. He would restore funding for the Global Terrorism Database and give the National Counterterrorism Center and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence the ability to investigate international links to white nationalist violence. He would stop violent extremism online by working with large social media companies to screen content. And he says consistent with the First Amendment, of course. And of course, then he also supports the other things that the other Democrats support, like banning assault weapons in high capacity magazines, passing red flag laws, repealing the law that protects gun companies from lawsuits, establishing a nationwide gun licensing system, and resuming federal funding for gun violence research. So, like, he supports a lot of the same bills that the other Democrats do that rely on Congress to pass them. But his first instinct is to expand and empower the national security state, including intelligence agencies, which is really troubling from a constitutional Bill of Rights perspective. And like I said earlier in the broadcast today, a lot of times when you expand domestic terrorism, that infrastructure, that money, that technology gets turned against groups on the left, not groups on the right.
And even if that doesn't happen under the Buttigieg administration, whoever comes after him might be prone to do that. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I just want to point out, too, 9 candidates so far have qualified for the September debates. Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, Beto O'Rourke, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, and Andrew Yang. 2 other candidates are close. Julian Castro and the rich guy Tom Steyer both need to reach 2% in just one more poll for them to qualify. Tulsi Gabbard has reached the funding threshold, but she needs to reach 2% and at least 3 more polls before she can qualify. The cutoff date for qualifying polls is August 28th, which is only 11 days from now. So it's possible that Julian Castro and Tom Steyer might make the cutoff. It would be much harder for Tulsi Gabbard, but yeah, she could potentially.
And Jay Inslee is not on that list.
Yeah, and Kirsten Gillibrand is still struggling to get both polls and is quite close on funding, but not quite there yet.
I could have sworn I got a Facebook ad from Jay this morning saying if he just reaches the 130,000 donors that he'll make it in.
Yeah, I think he hasn't reached the poll numbers yet
yeah,
either.
Yeah, he has not.
That's weird.
But yes, I get those Facebook ads too.
Yeah.
It's
as if the Facebook ads aren't all true.
I don't understand.
That's why they're ads.
It's on the internet. I swear it's true.
It's a really nice picture. All right. Let's move on to international, what we can get through on that. These have been going, Hong Kong protests.
Yeah, there's a lot of international crises going on this week that by and large don't get much attention in the U.S. media and would be getting action from a normal administration, except for the Trump administration, where he's more concerned about members of Congress visiting Israel. First on that list was the pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. Now, what that's about is that in 1997, when the British turned over Hong Kong to China, they negotiated a 50-year deal where there would be a separate administration for Hong Kong from that of mainland China, where they would retain their democratic leadership.
And traditions and law.
And now Beijing wants to abrogate that agreement and incorporate Hong Kong into the administration of mainland China. And, of course, you're seeing these massive protests and very creative and very brave protests in Hong Kong. The risk of that, of course, is that if China decides to crush them, then the leaders of that protest are simply never going to be seen again. It's a very brutal regime, which is one reason why Hong Kong doesn't want any part of it. But again, a lot of those protesters in Hong Kong are looking to America as a democratic ideal. And unfortunately, America is no longer that democratic ideal, at least not under the Trump administration, where he's trying to curry favor with mainland China and their government, even as he wages a trade war with them. So there's a lot of moving parts in terms of American foreign policy. And the commander-in-chief is asleep at the wheel, basically.
Yeah, well, no, I think he's actually, his instincts are to do the opposite of what nearly everyone else in the United States would do in that kind of situation, including his own advisors and other members of his party who are urging him to support the Hong Kong protesters, not the Chinese president. His automatic and knee-jerk reaction was to support President Xi and to say, yes, you know, kick the butt of those pro-democracy activists. And you have to scratch your head and go, what?
And there's a huge massing of Chinese military vehicles and troops, et cetera, outside Hong Kong. So that suppression of the protest may not be far away.
Yeah, it could be the military rolling into Hong Kong.
Yeah, which would be ugly.
Which would be terrible.
Well, and to further complicate things, the National Endowment for Democracy has been funding multiple organizations in Hong Kong, fueling the pro-U.S., you know, pro-democracy movement there. So,
And they have a very mixed record. I'm being generous in terms of
very questionable. Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of who they support.
Of bringing democracy anywhere.
Yeah. Exactly. But and this is being used by the Chinese government and various other anti-protester media to say these are not legitimate protests, these are foreign agitators.
On the other hand, they were responding to a law that Chinese government appointed head of the Hong Kong legislature had introduced, saying that people who are convicted of or people who are arrested for political crimes can be extradited to the mainland China. And that is in direct violation of the agreement that China signed with Hong Kong, saying that you will retain your own democratic law and institutions.
Yeah, that was the original genesis of these protests, but they've become much broader and wanting nothing to do with mainland China, basically. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see whether the people power there can win any concessions from an authoritarian
government. And a lot of it has been in reaction to the way the police have responded to the demonstrators, including encouraging violent gangs to go after the demonstrators in a sort of vigilante-style attacks.
Yeah, paramilitaries, which is China has a long history of using to go after dissenters.
Yeah, and also undercover police infiltrating the protest groups and trying to grab and arrest people they determine may be leaders of the protest groups.
So on the other hand, some of the tactics of the protesters have been wildly creative and well worth looking at for anybody who's interested in organizing things here.
Yeah.
Again, like other uprisings, you know, things are not always, as everyone knows, things are not always as they appear.
As cut and dry.
People need to look into the finer details.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to get to a couple other international things very quickly.
I was going to say, speaking of moving parts, especially ones that like are breaking apart at rapid rate.
Yeah, we had a major nuclear problem in northern Russia this week. A nuclear explosion at the Nenasko military facility on the Arctic Ocean. Apparently, Russia was testing an intercontinental ballistic missile that was using nuclear fuel, which is the technology that the U.S. looked at and rejected in the 50s and 60s as being too risky. But the explosion killed 7 people, mostly scientists, and the Putin government, not surprisingly, and very reminiscent of the reaction after Chernobyl, was consistently lying about what happened and then grudgingly admitting that, yes, this was nuclear. Yes, this did kill more people than we originally said. And there was apparently medical personnel who treated the injured were sent to Moscow hospitals, including a physician who had been exposed to cesium-137, which is extremely deadly. So, which becomes deadly when it's mixes with water. And this was apparently an explosion at sea. So, a very concerning levels of radiation, and very concerning that we don't know the full details of this, including how serious the leak was and the explosion. But that's something that's well worth keeping track of, because a lot of European groups are now investigating this and trying to find out the details of this. The Russian government, of course, is not being forthcoming at all.
All right. We're going to have to go to events quickly.
Okay, I have a couple for Wednesday. Wednesday, August 21st, it's contract negotiation time for all of the state's schools, and the Seattle Education Association is holding a rally for a fair contract for students and staff. That's from 4 to 5:30 p.m. at the John Stanford Center at 2445 3rd Avenue South. That's
the Glass Palace.
That's Wednesday from 4 to 5:30 p.m. And then also on Wednesday is Candidate Survivor 2019. The Stranger and Washington Bus are holding their City Council candidate pageant at 6 p.m. at Numos at 925 East Pike Street on Capitol Hill. So go check it out and see if any of the candidates for City Council this year are willing to do vaping. among some of the questions that they are asked.
Yeah,
it's kind of a fun event.
It's a fun event. It's not very policy oriented. It's more like Jackass for City Council.
And you get to kind of see what they're like as people, which can be quite interesting.
Yep.
And who can hold their smoke?
Yeah, it'd be quite interesting to see how Egan O'Brien and Phil Tavel and some of those Chamber of Commerce supported folks do against the incumbents that we have, like Shama Sawant and
Lisa Herbold.
Lisa Herbold, yeah.
All right. Well, then we will look forward to seeing you both here next week.
We will be here.
Well, I will be on vacation next week.
Oh, well.
Are you going to be here?
No, I won't be here next week. I will be on vacation.
Okay, well then we'll just
week
use your time to schedule contract negotiations.
While I'm gone. Well, thank you, Mike.